Hello and welcome to Parallel, a tech podcast with accessibility sprinkles. I'm Shelley Risman, your host, and this is episode 93 for June 25th, 2024. Well, as I mentioned previously, this is the final episode of Parallel, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the show, so I hope you'll stick around. Chapter markers are your friends. But before I do that, we have a really great show. The people who are on the show with me have a roundtable of several guests, all of whom have been on Parallel before, and all of whom know a lot about technology and accessibility, particularly in the Apple realm. And that's why I invited them along to go with me on a little journey back to 2009 when accessibility on the Apple platform began. So here we go. Well, we're just at the tail end of an eventful few weeks for the tech world in general and for Apple specifically, with much more to come. In the past few years, companies have settled on May and June as the time for big announcements about their software platforms. Microsoft, Google, and Apple have all hosted big events, trying to convince audiences of developers and press that what they have coming this year is better than ever. 15 years ago and more, Apple had this field to itself. The Worldwide Developers Conference has always been in June, and it's always been the showcase for new operating systems. First the Mac, and later for iOS and all those that came after. But something special happened in 2009. Apple, which had brought the VoiceOver screen reader to macOS 4 years before, did it for the iPhone too, which was great and all, but it came 2 full years after the first iPhone shipped. 2 full years in which few, if any, people with disabilities could effectively use the iPhone. And so, right there, I argue, right there in 2009 is where the modern era of mobile accessibility begins. With apologies for this long introduction, that's where we'll start our conversation today as well. Since the iPhone first got VoiceOver, most other platforms have found ways to keep up. And Apple has had to do more, too. Bringing accessibility for those with motor disabilities, hearing loss, cognitive delays, and speech limitations. So how are they doing? And how has the tech world done in general when it comes to advancing accessibility? Let's try and figure it out. I've got some wonderful guests with me today, and I want to introduce them to you now. Jonathan Mosen is former assistive technology product manager and accessibility consultant, and he's the host of the Living Blindfully podcast. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you, Shelley.
Micah Sargent is consumer technology journalist and host of too many podcasts for the Twit Network. I don't think they're too many. Relay FM and The Incomparable. Hi, Micah.
Hello, Shelley.
Steve Sausen is my fellow panelist on the Mac Accessibility Roundtable podcast. He's an accessibility consultant, and he remembers when the Mac became accessible. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks so much for having me.
Allison Sheridan is the host of the NoCillaCast podcast and co-host of Programming by Stealth. Hi, Allison.
Hi, how you doing, Shelley? This is going to be fun.
Last but not least, David Woodbridge never met a new tech product he didn't want to review for accessibility purposes. He is a technology consultant for Vision Australia and also a frequent podcaster. Hi, David.
I'll be really Australian. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate, to you as well. And thanks, everybody, for joining me. My idea for this podcast sort of comes out of the introduction where there was a moment when accessibility happened in the mobile space. It didn't exist before. And then when it did, people suddenly became aware that it was possible. And a lot happened in terms of Apple, and it seemed to have the accessibility field to itself. But that's kind of my construction. And I'd like to know, especially from those of you who have a long background in accessibility, do you agree with that? Do you think that's where accessibility, a modern accessibility era began, or am I missing something there?
No, I agree. I think that modern accessibility began at that point in 2009. But for some of us, Shelley, it was back to the future. Blind people were using Apple computers all the way back in the Apple IIe days. But Apple really changed the game because Apple in those days did what everybody was doing, Microsoft included, which was they knew accessibility was going on, but it was the purview of third-party screen readers. It was considered cool. And they kind of thought, yeah, this is nice, but they didn't really do much with it. When you get to 2009, of course, what had happened was that Apple had been dabbling in accessibility because of the Mac. And if they hadn't done it, that was potentially damaging to their lucrative education market in the United States because there were no third-party screen readers left for Mac. So Apple had to respond. And then it was a natural progression that they moved on to iPhone with their announcement in 2009.
I think for me, the thing that Apple did was to make accessibility available at the same time the device was available to everyone else. I had accessibility on mobile devices prior to the iPhone. Some of us may remember the good old Symbian days. But, you know, you couldn't just buy a Symbian phone, go home and use the thing. You had to first install a screen reader. You had to hope that it was updated to support the new model or a Symbian version. It was a complicated process. With the iPhone coming with VoiceOver installed, you could purchase it and use it right away. Literally walk out in the parking lot and use it just like everyone else that was using their iPhones. And so for me, I think the big thing that it changed was making accessibility part of the product versus an add-on to the product. And for me, it was a very emotional time because, frankly, it's hard to buy any device that's accessible right out of the box. I can't even find a microwave that I can go to the store right now, buy, come home and use. But the iPhone I could, and we're talking, you know, many years ago now. And so for me, that was very emotionally powerful to have the same ability to buy a device and use a device just like everybody else without having to wait for someone somewhere to build special software that hopefully might work with it.
I pride myself on never, ever being able to see the future. When I first saw the iPhone, I was like, nope, blind people are never, ever, ever going to be able to use this. Not going to happen.
And you were already paying attention to accessibility, Allison. You'd been doing NoSilicast for how long by then, by 2009?
Yeah. I don't know whether I was paying attention until VoiceOver came to the iPhone. I'm not sure I could claim that. I'm not very good at remembering when things happen, though, so I'll take credit if you want me to.
Well, you're in public. I don't know. Michael?
I can understand why you had that or have that sort of narrative because it was my understanding that, you know, Apple introduces VoiceOver and shortly later that same year, Google or Android at the time did introduce TalkBack, but it was a pretty limited screen reader and didn't have the integrations that VoiceOver did. And it wasn't until like 2012, so quite a few years later, before it had the, you know, true integration that was at the level that provided. So at least, you know, setting the stage and setting precedent and expectations, I think, is something that Apple might deserve credit for in that way.
I mean, VoiceOver was pretty limited too, to begin with, to be fair. There was only one form of input, and that was your standard typing, where you had to double tap everything. There was no Bluetooth support, so you couldn't use a Bluetooth keyboard, and there was no Braille support either. And I readily admit, I was a cynic when VoiceOver came out in 2009. I wondered whether Apple was doing just enough to get the regulators off their back. And my concern was, are they going to develop this? Is it going to be nurtured? And they absolutely have done that, as I'm sure we'll talk about later. But it was pretty rough and ready to begin with too on iOS.
No, look, I agree. I remember going down to Apple in Australia and having a look at the iPhone 3GS. And the really weird thing that stood out for me back then too was that my boss at the time, I think, said something almost along the lines of what Jonathan just said was, is this just a bit of a gimmick? Is it Apple just sticking something in, i.e. Narrator in Windows XP, for example, which you can sort of very pleasantly call it a screen reader if you want to. But I was quite amazed about how well it was. It's been developed through the years. So 2009, to me, was actually, it's one of those points in time where you look back and you think, geez, that was a good starting point. And I've also just got, for posterity, I've actually got my original iPhone 3GS in my hand. So I still remember it and can touch it every now and again. And I've even gone so far, Allison and Mike, to actually put on my wall a iPhone 3GS in this beautiful picture that's been, so the whole iPhone 3GS has been deconstructed and it's in this beautiful wooden frame on my bedroom wall, so I can even go to sleep with my iPhone at night time. How's that for being sad?
I can see my iPhone 4S in the same frame in my office. I'm looking at it right now.
And can I say it's Twit's fault, because if it wasn't for frigging Twit recommending, like, hey, guess what you can get now? You can get deconstructed technology. I wouldn't have ever got one. So, yeah, so it's not my fault.
Twit has been known to recommend a few products now and then.
Exactly. Yeah. Every now and again.
Yeah, we do that. We certainly do that.
So just for the purists out there, Micah correctly pointed out that Android did come up with TalkBack fairly soon thereafter. And just for the purists out there, I know that non-mobile operating systems, PCs, and of course the Mac, had screen readers. And on the PC side, there are screen readers that were not made by Microsoft that were, in fact, the standard and that people had been using for years. And so in 2009... the two things that were a big deal was that Apple had made what seemed like a bigger commitment to accessibility and that we had a mobile platform that had accessibility that was provided, as Steve says, at the same time that everybody else got their phones. You could open up the phone and, except that the batteries didn't come charged in those days, on the way home, you could actually turn your iPhone on with VoiceOver.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So I guess, and Jonathan, I'll start with you, but anybody else who wants to chime in, I'd love to sort of give the audience a sense of what assistive tech was like in 2009, because in those days, I think especially in the mobile world, but in general, there were a lot more purpose-built devices that did assistive tech. That was kind of what you did. If you wanted a GPS device or if you had a particular purpose in mind. So I guess I wonder, did you have the sense at that time when we were living in that world, and those devices are and were quite expensive relative to mainstream devices, did you have a sense that the iPhone would eventually replace a lot of that assistive tech? And what was the state of assistive tech at that time?
Not initially, Shelley. I think in 2009, the iPhone was primarily a content consumption device. And over time, for everybody, blind and sighted, it's evolved to be a content creation device as well. But I was working in the industry in 2009, and I was thinking about this today in preparation for chatting with you. As Steve says, we had talks for Symbian, and that was all right. Yeah, I think the difference with that was that we would struggle to find one app in a product category that was accessible. So we'd all be asking each other, is there a Twitter client that's accessible for Symbian, for example? And if you're lucky, you might have one. When iPhone really got into its stride, of course, we had as much choice as everybody else has. So that's a big difference. There was another product called MobileSpeak from a company called Code Factory, and that worked on Symbian as well as Windows Mobile. That was a pretty influential operating system back then, the old Windows Mobile. And then you have this category of product that still exists today, but was hugely popular then, the blindness note taker. So you had the PacMate, which I was responsible for, that was running on Windows Mobile. You had devices like the Braille Note, which I was responsible for before that, that was also running Windows CE, various devices like that. And if you wanted GPS, you would have to pair a Bluetooth GPS receiver to your device of that description, and then you'd have to buy another external product. So those devices would cost, you know, $5,000 depending on how many Braille cells you had. And then you'd get the Bluetooth GPS receiver, and then you'd get the product on top of that. So the barriers to entry were incredibly high. There was JAWS 11 that came out in 2009. And the big feature in JAWS 11 was a thing called Research It. So we've really come a long way in that time. So a lot of third-party devices, a lot of expense, pretty difficult to install. Sometimes a lot of blind people would rely on experts like David, for example, to go in and install these products for them because it was all just so complex. So a very different era.
I remember being frustrated that all of the mobile devices came with cameras. And I thought, this is just dumb. I'm not going to use a camera. It's a visual thing. It takes up space on the back of the device. And year over year, all we hear about is how better the camera is. What a waste of space for someone who can't see. And we fast forward to now, and the camera is absolutely essential. We can read text with it. We can do so many things with the camera. We can even take pictures with it, which is something I never could have imagined. And I think for me, that camera is sort of a reminder of how easily something was to dismiss and think we're never going to have a use for this, to, you know, something that has become truly essential. And it's things like that, which I think categorized for me many of the devices that were specialized in some way, or devices that worked, but as Jonathan mentioned, only with very limited apps. It sort of changed the mindset from this is the best we're going to get, we just got to be happy with it, to wow, we have all kinds of options. We can make choices in the same ways that other people make choices. Personal preference can play a part versus this is the option. And those are the things I think that really changed at that point for me in terms of what was available for accessibility.
Yeah, it's actually really funny because I remember when in 2009 I did a presentation, and I can remember still walking into this room and there was all these technology consultants from around Australia, and what I had was I had two tables set up with a white sheet on them. So there was two tables, and I pulled off the first sheet and I said, and if you think I'm going to go through and talk about each one of these 35 products on the table, you'd be wrong. And then I pulled off the other sheet on the other table, and all that was on the table right in the middle of it was an iPhone 3GS. And I said, that's the device I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about those other 35 items on the other table, because the iPhone 3GS has now replaced all those 35 items. I don't need a talking clock and a talking watch and this and that and the other thing. And it was just quite amazing at the time that, I know the App Store started off a little bit slow, and, you know, we gradually got more and more apps to use. And I don't know why people always got fart apps to begin with, because obviously adults need to listen to fart sounds apparently. But it was just amazing. And I still did a podcast last year for work, another demo, and I still said it's getting less. But I often think sometimes we're swinging a little bit back towards dedicated devices a little bit, but no, that was the thing that I always liked about the iPhone 3GS, and when the App Store became more prevalent, that we're on a good track.
Yeah, the next thing I was going to talk about was actually developers and the role of apps, because I think as soon as people got these devices, they wanted to use the apps that everybody else did. And so a lot of people I knew, I'm sure Steve is among them, were trying to find the apps that everybody else that they were reading about and listening to on tech podcasts was downloading. Is this one accessible? Is that one accessible? And I wonder, how quickly do you think that, obviously not all apps are accessible even today. Many are. Most are. I guess I could say that. Maybe just say many. Let's be conservative about it. But I guess I wonder at what point the issue became accessibility and communicating with developers and sort of letting them know, hey, this is a thing. We'd really like it if you'd make your app accessible to this thing that you may not have even heard of yet called VoiceOver.
And if I could, I was just going to add to that question, as someone who does not require too many of any accessibility features, I would just love to hear the experience over time as it either has gotten better or worse for you being able to reach out and ask for accessibility improvements, and just like the experience of needing to do that, of hearing about a new app that you want to try and trying it and finding that it falls flat in terms of accessibility or that it could use improvements. If you could talk about what that's like and if that's gotten any better over time and if people are more receptive or not. I don't mean to
pull away from you, Shelley,
but I feel like that adds to this question.
Yeah, there's so much we take for granted, right? I think one of the key things that helped with all of this was the App Store itself, because in the days of Symbian and Windows Mobile, there wasn't that really central repository that a blind person could go to even browse for apps. So you might go to a website where you'd heard that there was a particular app that may or may not be accessible, and you might first have to contend with traversing that website to get the app in the first place. And then you'd have to use a convoluted app like Nokia PC Suite or something to transfer it to your device. So the barriers to entry to even get a third-party app on your device were pretty huge. So you had the App Store making that so much easier. There was was just one place to go. And then I think one of the really cool things about this whole experience has been the indie developers. And it was those indie developers in the first instance who really got it. And I think of people who've been around since the early days, like Greg Pierce, who makes a wonderful app called Drafts, and he really embraced accessibility. Various others as well, apps like Flexi, things that have come and gone over the years. And what a lot of us found was that if you approached those indie developers, even if they didn't know about VoiceOver when you first made the approach, they'd look at it. It was easy to find. They didn't have anything to download. They just had to pop into accessibility settings to take a look. And you would get the occasional indie developer who just got it. They kind of got the religion and they got really enthusiastic and they got almost obsessive about making their apps accessible. And what they soon discovered was the blind community was growing very quickly once VoiceOver came out. You know, the word was spreading and they found the blind community to be an engaged niche audience. And there was a little bit of a competitive advantage there to begin with, because not everybody knew what an engaged niche audience we were. So those early adopters of accessibility really had an advantage and they've stuck with it. So we have a lot to thank them for, I think. And then gradually pressure has been brought to bear on some of the larger app developers who are harder to deal with. And it isn't perfect, because sometimes you try and make an approach about an app that you really want to use and you don't get anywhere. Or you have a situation like the one that we've been experiencing recently with Sonos, where they've completely rewritten a perfectly good app and broke it to smithereens. And we had to keep agitating pretty loud to be heard.
You know, I'm not visually impaired myself, but what I like to try to do when I test out applications, I'm doing a review, is I have rudimentary skills with VoiceOver. And so I go through and I try to test it. And in my testing, I can tell you, nope, nothing for you here. So I can tell you if it's terrible. I can tell you if it's kind of mediocre, but there's a lot of times where I'm like, well, it seemed accessible to me, but I haven't, you know, I don't know everything. So it's worth a shot. And some of the things I found were really interesting. I remember I wrote to a dev once and said, I said, hey, you know, your app's really good, really accessible, but there's this one table that I can't get into. And I think you need to fix that. And his answer was great. He went, my app's accessible? Cool. How'd I do that? And I said, well, you apparently followed the APIs correctly, as you got lucky that way. But the thing that really, I think, changed a lot in my ability to debate with developers, if they ever give any pushback, is when Rogue Amoeba redesigned Audio Hijack. So an app that is 100% visual. I mean, it was, you know, even the way it's designed for someone who's sighted, you can't imagine that it's accessible, but it is. And when they did that, that was every excuse in the book. When I talk to devs and they're like, oh, it sounds really hard, it's like, look at Rogue Amoeba. Come on. If they can do it, you can do it. So I feel like they kind of broke the mold there of any excuses anybody has.
I think one of the, just adding on to what Jonathan said, I agree. The indie developers have been phenomenal to work with. And I think one of the advantages that they have is they're not constrained, as are oftentimes larger corporate type developers, to, you know, by a roadmap and by agile processes and all of that sort of stuff. It's very hard to talk to a developer. Sometimes you contact support, it has to get escalated, it has to get changed around. You have to explain accessibility is not a feature. It might get to an engineer, it might make it to a roadmap. There's a lot of steps. Whereas if you wrote to Twitterific back in the day, you'd get an answer from one of the developers. And it was real easy to have that conversation to help the developer understand and for them to figure out how could they implement accessibility in a very graceful way, along with everything else that was being implemented. And I feel in many ways it's more challenging now to get the attention of the right people. And even if you have the attention of the right people, you know, I've gotten responses from some engineers who say, yeah, I totally get it, but I can't put it on the roadmap. I'll put it forth in our next, you know, product meeting, which is a nice way of saying I might see it or I might, you know, probably won't.
I don't know if that's specific to the blind accessibility issues or any accessibility issues in general. If I have a developer where like I want to get an enhancement or a feature, and it's an indie developer, I can almost always get something. At least they'll answer me with a truthful answer of like, I'm put on my list, but I don't know when I'm getting to it. But the big companies never respond to you at all on a good day. So yeah. It might not just be for that.
And it's not, right? That's definitely very true. But those companies tend to do a lot of testing and that sort of thing. I think the difference is that a feature would make the product better, but accessibility makes it usable or not.
Oh, yeah. Your questions are more important than mine, but the answer might be the same.
Yeah, I actually remember back in 2009, because I don't think back then people actually realized there was anything to do with accessibility on the iPhone. They certainly didn't know about VoiceOver. And I can remember there was two apps in particular that stood out for me. One was called VoiceBrief, and the other one was called, Navigator, but that might be the wrong name for the app. It was a GPS app at the time. And neither two of them actually even realized about VoiceBrief. So VoiceBrief at the time could read out your emails, it could do Twitter, it could do all sorts of things. And then it was designed for people listening in cars and driving. And I can remember emailing the guy and said, hey, mate, look, this would be really fantastic for blind people. And he said, well, why would blind people want to use it? They can't drive. And I went, yeah, no. I'm talking about when you're sitting in your lounge, your feet up and your glass of wine, and you want to listen to all your social media stuff or your emails. He went, oh, I didn't even think about that. And then the reason why Navigator came to mind too was because they had this function where they had two types of pedestrian mode. They had pedestrian mode with speech and pedestrian mode without speech. And I can remember they took the speech out, so it didn't say, turn left, turn right. And they took it out because they went, well, look, sighted people, obviously when they're walking around, they don't need to be told when to turn left and turn right. And I can remember at the time, all blind people threw up their hands in despair and went, what the hell are you talking about? And they went, oh, yeah, that's a good point. So I think sometimes when people change mainstream features in products, they don't really realize the impact across the whole user perspective of actually using the product. So I can remember back then I always took the view of, well, obviously you don't realize the full implications, so let me educate you on the matter, which is more or less what we're doing today. But I remember back then I was more likely to be a lot more sensitive about them not knowing about it, whereas these days I think there's really no excuse about why you shouldn't have investigated accessibility in the first place, along with everything else for that matter.
I've found this really weird thing is that blind people want to do everything sighted people can do. Did you know that?
That's outrageous. Jeez.
Sometimes I feel like it's a design thing too, because somebody, and I think Sonos comes to mind, where they've redesigned the app. A lot of what they've done is to create a certain design language about it. And whether they intended to or not, they broke accessibility. And fixing it requires a little bit more than, oh, well, go and unbreak that thing you already broke, because they've completely redesigned the app. And I sometimes wonder if you're talking to a developer who said, I'm going to completely redesign the app, or I'm going to create an app that's based on a very visual design language, whether they don't have more trouble hearing you because they're like, yeah, but this app is really pretty and it does all these things and it looks great. And now you're telling me that blind people want to use it. Have any of you run into that sort of issue?
Yeah. I mean, what I try to say to app developers is you can have both. I mean, there's no reason, for example, even though the Sonos app now has everything on one massive screen, that you can't create an accessible, efficient voiceover experience. It would require some judicious use of the actions rotor and some pretty sort of deep parts of Apple's accessibility infrastructure, but it can be done. But I think there still is a perception, even after all these years, that something visually pleasing cannot be accessible.
Well, and I had a fight with Ivory, which is now a much more accessible Mastodon client, but they would not respond to me. It was one of the rare cases of an indie developer that just would not engage. And I think I still harbor some ill feelings about that, because we've gotten to the point now in 2023 and 2024 where we have some expectation that, especially if we make our case intelligently and in language the developer can understand, that we should at least get some sort of response. And I did not in that case and have since found other choices. But I think that's the frustration. We do, I think, have higher expectations than we might have in 2009, and we absolutely should have, because there's no reason developers can't make their apps accessible if they want to. And it's unfortunate when you find one that is resistant for whatever reason.
One of the things I like about the folks that are on this panel here is they fit the model. You all, I'm going to compliment you here. You fit the model that I try to ask people to do is when you're trying to convince a developer to enhance something for accessibility, don't just yell at them. You know, you guys take the approach of, here, this is why it's an advantage to the blind community. Here's what it's going to do for you. You know, can I'm willing to help you figure out where the missing pieces are. Let me detail out what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. I can test it for you if you want. People who talk like that, I think you tend to get more feedback. I've had a few friends where they're like so angry all the time. It's like, okay, well, good luck with getting any help with that.
I think the problem, though, that comes into play is that so often we hear no.
Yeah.
And so often we hear, oh, we'll put that on the feature request list. And it doesn't excuse that sort of behavior by any means, but you just get to a point where, and I admit I've gotten to that point where I write a bug report and I'll write, you know, the first sentence and I'll think, do I even want to do this? Is it, am I ready to hear how this is another feature request or something they're going to look into? Do I want to fight this battle? Yeah. And oftentimes I close the window. I'm just tired. The thing is, as much as I'm a techie, I really just want to live my life, right? Ultimately, I just want to do the things I want to do. And those things don't include writing, trying to find addresses and contact methods and advocating for accessibility just to do a thing, right? And I think that makes it really challenging and has an impact on attitude, which is unfortunate. I fully admit that. But I think that's unfortunately where a lot of that comes from, is that sometimes you get the developer who does really want to help. And yet, you know, that might be the 9th or 10th time in a given week. You've already heard no 9 or 10 times. And so not the fault of that developer, but they unfortunately sort of get the end result of that, which is challenging. The other piece too is sometimes it's hard to communicate what the problem actually is. I often feel that, and I've been in accessibility for a long time, but I'm not a developer. And so I think sometimes it's hard for me to articulate in development terms what's going on, and specifically in iOS. If it were a web page, I could do it easily, but it isn't. And so I could say, you know, if this were a web page, this is what the problem might be. You know, please translate that into you know, iOS speak, but I don't have an easy way to do that. And sometimes I come across people who are like, you know, I want to report the issue and I can say what's happening, but I feel really stupid. And then I hear back, you know, please send us a screenshot. And I can't do that because it's not a visual problem. And so I think there's a lot of challenge there as well, where people want to be helpful and don't really know how to be, or are being asked for information, like screenshots is the big one, where
yeah,
often that's the wrong
and
input.
One of the things we can thank Apple for, Steve, in this regard, is the really cool screen recording feature they introduced, so that you can make a video for a developer where you can have them hear what VoiceOver is doing and they can see on the screen what you're experiencing. And that has been such a breakthrough in terms of trying to engage with developers about some issues.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I wonder whether the new iPhone mirroring to your screen thing will help too. So if you can see your iPhone on your Mac and you could record it from there, I wonder if there's going to be any advantages to everybody trying to show bugs through making a video. I definitely find that making videos does more.
Yeah, and remote control is coming to iOS 18 as well. So the combination of being able to share your screen and potentially have somebody with your consent remote control your phone so that they can see what you're trying to do, that's a very positive development this year.
Remote control, definitely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. The control of being able to show your iPhone screen on the Mac, you can do potentially live demos. So if you're sitting with a developer, you can show them on a great big Mac screen, this is what the phone looks like. And obviously they can keep a recording of that, but it just gives you many more avenues for showing what's going on.
That'll be cool. Every once in a while, I get a really fun surprise, and I don't want to call out the developer, but it's a pretty big application that all of you would know about. But they had basically broken their Mac app, so it wasn't accessible. The iPhone app was, and the Mac app was just like, I mean, hot garbage would be the best way to describe how well it worked with VoiceOver. But I wrote to the developer and I said, look, you know, I can't get inside this table here. And if you can't get in that table, there's nothing to do in your app. This really needs to be fixed. And I didn't hear from this person. I was really kind of disappointed because it was like, come on, you know, used to work. And like 7 months later, he wrote back to me and went, okay, I'm ready to work on it now. Who do you have that can help me test what I'm working on? It's just like, he just never told me he was going to do it. He just never responded. And then 7 months later said, okay, I'm ready.
That also sounds like he's putting a lot of the onus on you. You're the one that brought him that to the attention. Why is he not finding his own beta testers?
I had volunteered. So I had said, look, I have a bunch of blind friends who can tell you. I mean, I can tell you if you get it less broken, but I can't tell you if it's good. I know people that I can send to you. And I have a short list of people I trust that I send to developers because I know they're not just going to scream at them. Because if the developer's reaching out saying, I'd like to have some people test this, then usually they're open-minded and they don't deserve to get hollered at to start.
I just want to acknowledge... because, and I know that you all feel this and in some ways talk about it, but I just think it's worth acknowledging how frustrating it must be to, I mean, you talked about just being tired. And I think, you know, you don't need to hear me say this to you, but like, I want to say it to the people who are listening to this, that I can't imagine. It must be really frustrating. And as you said, tiring to literally, you just want to use the darn thing, but now suddenly you have to, you're forced into becoming an advocate and you are forced into, you know, sitting down and taking the extra 3 hours to figure out how to talk about it. And it's great that now there are features that make that a little bit easier, but the fact that you have to do it in the first place, deserves to be acknowledged. And in that sense, I think that the developers, could stand to have perhaps a little bit more empathy or sympathy that when they are getting shouted at, if they are feeling shouted at, that an understanding that this must be a frustrating thing, because ultimately what you're saying to them is, I like what you made and I'd love to be able to use it. That's all you're saying. So for, you know, this idea that, oh, you've got to approach them a certain, you know, it's a bear in the wild and you've got to approach them a certain way or else they're just going to run off into the woods. I don't know if I like that idea. I think that the developers could stand to be a little bit more open-minded about it and understanding. And I know we don't live in a perfect world where that's the case. And so I understand where Allison's coming from in the sense that you have to approach them a certain way, but it's kind of a stick in my craw or whatever. That is the fact that's the way that it has to be done. And I wish that there was a little bit more understanding and more importantly, action being taken on that front. And I guess that is kind of, you know, when it comes to getting those features through, it does make me curious, you know, for you, Shelley, and for others, do you ever find yourself reaching out to the rest of the community for help in getting something through? Because what you were talking about earlier with Ivory, I honestly didn't know that you had so much trouble with that. Have you ever thought about sort of bringing more people in? And is that something that you consider every single time you have to strap on your advocacy shoes and go out there and fight the good fight? Is that a consideration that you have to make? Or do you often just kind of go, okay, if they're not going to listen to me, then we just move on and try something else?
In the particular case of Ivory, and I'm glad to talk about that, and then I want to throw it to Jonathan to talk about Sonos. But in the case of Ivory, I did it very publicly on Mastodon. I did not, and whether you were following my feed or not, which is not your responsibility to do, I did it very publicly on purpose. I wanted them to know exactly who I was and that I had something of a platform, that I had written about this stuff. I made a very long thread with extremely detailed and specific and not angry requests and points about things that were and weren't accessible. And I never got any feedback from this. So that, to that extent, and I think I probably mentioned it on a few podcasts at the time, but it is difficult. Like if you have the ability to make noise, figuring out exactly how much noise to make and in what place is kind of a difficult thing. And Ivory is a hard case because Tapbots, that company is well regarded. People love Ivory. They loved Tweetbot. Tweetbot also had many accessibility problems, and I'd given up on it years ago. And when Mastodon came around as a thing, and Ivory was the sort of product of choice for a lot of people on both Mac and iOS, I should say, I was like, okay, well, let me see what the accessibility situation is. And I even gave, they went through a long beta process. And so I was happy about that because it meant that during the beta process, I could feel comfortable publicly saying, hey, here's something that you might not have thought about, but you're not accessible to VoiceOver and in these particular ways. And as I say, I tried to do it with all the tact I possibly could. And what bothered me, and as I say, I have hard feelings. And I think one of the reasons it bothers me is because I have a little bit of recognition and sway in this community, maybe not a lot, but I have a little. And I thought I at least deserved the privilege of a response, and I didn't get any. And that's why I continue to mention it, I suppose. There are other instances in which, especially if it were a small part of the app that was inaccessible, but the rest of it does seem to be accessible, where I might go privately to a developer or email them or even find somebody I know in common with the developer. There are all sorts of ways based on your own experience with that particular product. And I felt Ivory was important because it was getting so much praise at the time.
Yeah.
It was like, that's what people are turning to when they join Mastodon. And so many people in the Mac and iOS community love that company, and they're an indie developer. And I felt like if there's ever a time to have somebody be responsive, this is it. And it didn't work out.
Shelley, you'll be glad to know that just yesterday I was talking about something about Mastodon, and somebody said, oh, you know, in Ivory, you can blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, you know, I started with Ivory. But then when I saw all the blind community going, whoa, have you guys tried Mona? This thing is amazing. Look at that. And everybody was talking about Mona, and I switched because it was accessible, and I still use it because it's accessible. It doesn't have any direct benefit to me, but I'm like, why wouldn't I use it? That's awesome. It's a great app.
It's a good app. That's the other thing. It's not.
I actually like it better too. I like the icons better.
I very much like it. I think their integration between the Mac and the iOS versions was better initially. And so when I switched, I was happy. And some of that, I think Jonathan might've mentioned it on one of his shows. I think that might've been one of the ways that I first became aware of it. But Jonathan, I want you to talk about Sonos, because obviously you had Sonos gear. That's the other thing. With Sonos, it's kind of a special situation because you've invested in hardware. You've got a system in your house, and then all of a sudden, the thing that runs that system is not accessible. But you created a very specific, very public campaign to get Sonos to pay attention to what the blind community needed.
Ooh, so much to unpack here. I want to acknowledge what Steve said about picking your battles, because it can be exhausting. I don't want to pick on Sonos too much, but then you know what? In a short time, I feel I'll get over that sentiment. So I have purchased, as my wife will tell you repeatedly, 15 Sonos devices that are active in our household at the moment. And if you can imagine how it feels to wake up one morning and face the real prospect that thousands and thousands of dollars worth of investment is going to become useless to you simply because of something that was eminently preventable, it's deeply frustrating. Now, I have been an advocate for a long time. There'll be people listening to this podcast who don't know me, but I was a government relations professional for a long time. I've got a lot of legislation changed and done some things that have even had international impact. So I come with that pedigree and that skill set to this. And I also have the responsibility, and I've had to come to terms with this, of a large platform by Blame the Standards. So sometimes I do get approached by people asking me to advocate on certain subjects that are important to them. And I, for my own mental health and also just for time considerations and is this in the interest of the wider community, have to pick those battles. So there are all those things. And then you get some people who just don't agree with me when I do take up a particular course of advocacy. And they say, well, who are you to speak on behalf of the blind community? And I don't really claim to speak on behalf of anybody else other than me. If other people agree with me, then they're welcome to chime in. And if they disagree with me, they're welcome to take a different course of action. So I take all of that into consideration because I realize the responsible position I'm in, and it's sort of a burden as well as a responsibility. But in the case of Sonos, you know, I had a long-standing relationship with them. In the past, I've been able to ping the chief executive and get a response. In this case, no one was responding. Somebody was very upset and approached me who was on the beta team, getting no traction. They essentially had to blow the whistle, and they said to me, I think you need to know that this app that's about to be released into the wild is really, really bad. I mean, it's not just got a few rough edges. This thing is essentially immobilizing Sonos devices for blind people. So I did go in very hard on that. I think it was Mike asking the question about engaging the wider community. And that's a really interesting question because it's a double-edged sword doing that. Sometimes I have chosen to go that route and used, say, a subreddit or something to spread the word out to sighted people who I would hope might be sympathetic. And I've got a terrible, demoralizing backlash from trolls, essentially, who don't even know that blind people can use computers or iPhones or whatever. And just say, why don't you get someone to read it to you? And it's actually, you know, it's really demoralizing. Seriously. So I did take my advocacy life into my hands in the case of the Sonos one, though, and put it on the Sonos subreddit. And the response I got was incredibly positive. And there's no doubt at all that doing it that time really did up the ante on Sonos. And a lot of sighted Redditors were saying, how can you possibly do this to blind community who've paid all this money? And let's not forget that blind people are typically in a socio-demographic place where an investment in any of this stuff is a big deal. You know, they might have saved for a very long time. They might be on some sort of fixed income. So they've invested in good faith, and there's a social contract there that this technology is going to remain accessible. And Sonos, out of the blue, breaks that social contract when they should have known better. So, yeah, I did go hard. And we are making some progress, but it is a big decision to know what causes I should take up in such a public way.
That was probably the best example I've ever seen of the blind community banding together to make change. I mean, that was loud. That was really loud. I mean, it needed to be, it was great to see that. I mean, is it a correct statement that it worked to be that loud?
You do have to strategize, and you have to think what tool in the advocacy toolbox is the right one for this particular occasion. But I think we did get it right with Sonos.
Let me switch us back to Apple a little bit, because I think that Apple got the sort of benefit of being first in mobile accessibility. And then I think, and I get asked this all the time whenever I'm on a podcast, basically people who are not part of the accessibility community writ large, they want some reassurance that Apple continues to be the leader and the best. So obviously this is an Apple-oriented media where I spend a lot of my time. And there is this sort of sense in the way that people ask it, that they're like, Apple's still great, right? We love them for accessibility, right? And so I'll just ask that question of those of you who live in the accessibility world. Apple's still great, right? They're awesome. They've never done anything wrong, right? Obviously, sarcasm.
Yes and no.
Into the mess.
Look, the overall answer to it is still yes. The underlying point, though, is that they still slip up like any other company does, and they still need to get feedback on stuff. I mean, to me, I guess the overall thing to do with Apple in general is that it's so cross-platform these days. So you've got the watch, the iPhone, the iPad, you know, the HomePod, the Apple TV and everything else. And it's all the cross-platform stuff that really gets me into the Apple ecosystem. And I'm often emailing Apple Accessibility about stuff to do with the Mac in particular, because I think sometimes I'm sitting there at a presentation and they're going on and on about the iPhone and the iPad and this and that and the other thing. And I go, you know, Apple also produces a thing called the Macintosh, don't you? It's been around for quite a long time as well. Can we also talk about that? So they're the little bits that I think sometimes we get so focused on particular stuff to do with Apple, whereas I like to take a bit of a back seat and look at all the cross-platform stuff, because I just don't use my iPhone. I use everything with it. And then, of course, I also use, you know, I use my Braille display, I use my Bluetooth keyboard, I use audio devices, I use all sorts of things, again, all across the platform. So, and it's that old adage about, you know, for example, when we consider to be screen readers in general, you know, JAWS for Windows from Vispero is always considered to be the, you know, the Mercedes-Benz of screen reading, which it still is. And I just wish, for example, that, you know, beloved Apple, not so much on the mobile side of things, but the Mac side of things, would spend a lot more attention to VoiceOver than just updating it. So for me, Apple indeed is good, but it still needs a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for me, one of the real frustrating things is, you know, I understand they're not going to jump on every single bug that we raise, but there are some and have been some significant bugs in iOS. And I think, you know, if these were issues that impacted the sighted, the product wouldn't ship. For example, very prevalently in iOS 16, there was a bug where randomly VoiceOver would just stop talking. And 30 seconds later, it might come back. It might be a little longer than 30 seconds. Sometimes you could lock your phone and unlock it and it would come back, but you wouldn't have any speech, wouldn't have any idea what was going on, couldn't interact with anything, no speech. And it was an extremely annoying bug that was raised over and over again. And I thought, you know, if a monitor or the screen just went black for 30 seconds randomly, it would never ship. It would never, ever ship. And yet this was somehow okay, that the only way we have to access this would just shut off for 30 seconds and then hopefully come back. And it wasn't that Apple wasn't aware of this. Plenty of people raised it. It was a very publicly known issue, and it just didn't get attention release after release after release. And I thought, you know, this isn't right. So I think there are, I agree. I think Apple is doing a great job, but there are issues that are very prevalent issues that don't get resolved. And I kind of wonder sometimes if Apple really understands the impact of these issues. Another one that I'm encountering a lot is Safari will just randomly refocus me on the page. I don't know why it does this, but I'll be reading along and enjoying whatever I'm reading, and all of a sudden I'll be moved by VoiceOver focus moves to somewhere else on the page completely. Then I've got to figure out where I was so that I can continue reading what I was reading in the first place. This is hugely frustrating if I'm just trying to read articles, right? And again, if the monitor were to just randomly scroll and move someone randomly into some other part of the web page, people wouldn't put up with it at all and it wouldn't ship. And yet the only thing I can do is wait and wait and wait and hope that it eventually gets fixed, or that there's some workaround that someone finds, which might be super annoying, but probably not as annoying as being focused on some random content on the page. So I echo what David said. I would love to see Apple do better across the board, both in terms of new features. It's always good to have new features, but just ensuring that the old ones, the current feature set, is truly tested, and that bugs that are raised, especially those that are critical, do get resolved in a timely fashion. I'd be happy with that. I would be happy if there was no voiceover updates in the next update, if they just fixed all the existing bugs. That would make me super happy. And I realize others are, you know, may not agree with that, but I would be super jazzed if in iOS 18, they introduced no new features, just fixed all of the existing problems. I'd be over the moon with that.
And who can forget the good old one from, I think it was iOS 9, where a lot of us couldn't even answer the phone.
God.
For
that's
like,
right.
That's right.
These are really serious issues. Last year, I gave a speech at the National Federation of the Blind's convention where I discussed these issues in public, and I proposed a concept called a defect equity framework, which really addresses what Steve was just talking about. If this bug were to be translated into a sighted context, what would be the equivalent? And if you wouldn't ship the product with the equivalent for sighted people, it is morally wrong to ship it for blind people. And I am hoping that the National Federation of the Blind will progress this in some form and work with the industry to get this done, because I think it is important. Gosh, just give me a second, because there was something that was coming out of that. I think this comes down to a cultural issue. You see Tim Cook, for example, spending a lot of time in China, and Apple modifies its behaviors quite a bit because the Chinese market is important to it. Now, obviously, we are not comparing apples with apples, if I might use the expression, because China is an incredibly large, lucrative market, and we're this tiny crinkle on the potato chip of life or whatever we are. But the principle is the same. When you go into a unique market, you need to behave in a culturally appropriate way. And there's a fundamental clash between the secrecy inherent in Apple's culture and our culture in the disability community, which is nothing about us without us. And Apple's got very skilled and very lucky, therefore, at coming up with some killer features. We might not have been consulted about them very widely. We might not have known they were coming, but they've done a brilliant job at the features. But where they fall short is that they do not engage in a constructive, sensible manner over all of the defects that are piling high. And that's where they're behaving culturally appropriately. Now, we've seen Apple having to behave differently because of EU changes, and we need to continue to force Apple to behave differently in terms of the inappropriate level of engagement with the disability community. So I do hope that that will change.
Yeah, actually, one thing I sort of want to add, and I've noticed over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 to 10 years, when Jonathan was talking about the culture stuff, I also think there's this almost shift from people that truly understand accessibility. When I say accessibility, I mean for anybody. So rather than having, you know, as a help desk person or as a software testing engineer, rather than having a list of bullet points that you've got to cross off and double check and you've got to do quality control and so on and so on, there's almost that missing complete understanding of what's happening under the hood as far as software is concerned. So you can know about the facts in general, but if you don't understand the implications of what's happening with the software itself, then the overall product starts to diminish. So I've noticed in the last couple of years when I've emailed accessibility and they seem to have new staff there, when I sort of engage in my normal conversation type stuff about a bit of bug checking, I sort of more or less almost get the, you know, hi, I'm a computer science person. I've just finished my degree last year. We had a module or two on accessibility, so here's my answer, versus, well, I've been working on software development with accessibility over the last 3 to 4 years. Let's have a discussion about it. So I think the brain's trust for accessibility in some ways with Apple seems to be decreasing. I don't know if people are moving on or they're trying to make it more of a bullet point thing that you just check off when you're testing stuff. But I really do get this overall feeling that the overall brain's trust of accessibility, particularly with iOS, is falling by the wayside a bit.
Yeah, and I want to come back to Micah's point about reaching out, because this is appropriate here. I get contacted by a lot of journalists about a lot of tech topics, and they'll happily print my words about all sorts of topics. But when I get a relationship with a journalist and I say to them, you know, you really need to look into the quality control issues that are plaguing Apple, they all clam up. And one of the reasons for that is that Apple is known to be quite punitive in its behavior. And I genuinely think that there is a bit of a scandal here that mainstream tech journalists know about the quality control issues with Apple accessibility, but they're fearful of covering it because they are worried about losing their access to Apple. And those journalists are doing us no favors by essentially being complicit in a cover-up.
I think there's probably also, with mainstream folks, the fear that they might not understand the issues and that they might feel like they're having somebody like you or like me or like Steve or like David, who may be the squeaky wheel getting the grease, and as articulate and smart as we try to be about the ways that we express ourselves, there's this tendency to think, oh, well, maybe that's just the one person who's really mad about this thing or that thing. And that's the fear I have. I don't have any specific examples that would give that as evidence. But yeah, I've talked a lot about, and I've pointed to things like the Apple Viz survey, where people are very specifically addressing bugs. Some of them are doing so in a less or more angry fashion than others. But I feel like instances in which the community, either as individuals or as a group, has come out and said, hey, this is a thing that's really a problem. I think people who don't live with this stuff every day sometimes aren't, they don't know how to address it. That's not to make an excuse. That's just to say, I feel like that's the thing in the pit of their stomach that keeps them from addressing it. I agree with you, though, that there are access issues as well. There are a lot of people who are very dazzled by Apple Park. And if I hear another podcaster talk about how awesome it was to go to Apple Park, I'm just like, come on. I get it. It's pretty and the food was good.
Well, I'll say the food's not good, so... Don't worry. The food is not good. I actually, on that subject, though, I wanted to ask you, when I'm looking for what's the latest news with anything to do with Apple and surrounding stuff, you know, I know the sites I go to. What if I'm looking for, you know, you talked about there were a lot of people who experienced this bug and they talked about this bug. Is there a place where accessibility concerns in tech are cataloged and where, you know, journalists could go to see that there's an audience. It's not, you know, with Shelley talking about maybe there's fear that it's just one person that shows, you know, these are all the folks who are having an issue with this. Because I think that it would be good to have some sort of place or places where those kinds of issues can be tracked, so that I think awareness, you know, is always the first step. Mm-hmm.
There's a website called Apple Viz that does quite a lot of this work. And also Living Blindfully, my podcast, has a lot of listener contributions. And so when something really hits the blind community, we air a lot of calls or read a lot of emails from listeners. There's a high level of engagement and we cover a lot of these issues on there. But mm-hmm. as part of my defect equity framework proposal that I gave in my speech to the NFB convention last year, I was actually proposing a public database on all of these mm-hmm. defects so that it would require technology companies to report on the progress or otherwise that they are making with these bugs. I think there needs to be a lot more transparency. That certainly doesn't sit well with many commercial entities, but particularly Apple, that is so secretive. But I do think that we need to treat bug reports differently. They should be public. We should be able to track them all and find out when we're going to get resolution.
I just really want to quickly say, David, I want to acknowledge that this conversation has been almost exclusively about accessibility for blind and visually impaired users, and that a point that I make there is that if there's a bug in Switch Control that's a deal killer, if there's a bug in Assistive Touch or in Personal Voice or any of the other accessibility tools, I may know a little bit about it because I write a book about it on a yearly basis, but I suspect that most of us are not digging into the details of switch control or how well hearing aids pair or any of the other things that have to do with different disabilities. And so the advantage of whether it's a public database of all the bugs or just a community where more people can be involved is that those of us who are focused on a particular area of accessibility wouldn't have to do all the heavy lifting, and that there would be folks who are, people who are using the Vision Pro without hands, for example, or people who are trying to use a switch control to run an iPhone or a Mac would have just as much opportunity to contribute to the bugs and the problems that may or may not exist for Apple products.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, there's a much broader conversation in that context, right? There are lots of other issues, and for various reasons, we don't hear about them very much. Apple Viz is a great resource. Jonathan's podcast is an amazing resource. I don't know that I could point to one that is focused on the challenges that folks who are deaf encounter. And so I think there are a lot of other issues that are even harder to find than our issues, because we're really good at advocating and about, you know, publicly raising issues and that sort of thing. Other groups are not, and yet those issues are just as debilitating for them as some of the voiceover issues are for us. And so I love the idea of the transparency. I mean, I realize it sort of flies in the face of everything Apple does, but these are critical things. And I think being able to track them, it would mean a culture shift, and it doesn't necessarily mean every single bug has to be visible, although I wish that were the case, but especially the accessibility bugs. Because the other part too is, I think oftentimes people wonder, is it just me? Mm-hmm. Am I doing something wrong? And it would be great to be able to go to a resource and see, oh, 50 other people reported the same issue. Jonathan mentioned when they broke the phone a while ago, and I remember that as well. And there was another time they broke the keypad, and we couldn't dial any numbers on the keypad during a call. And I thought I had done something, and it wasn't me. But if I wasn't on Twitter and connected with other people, I wouldn't have known that. It would have been great to have the validation that this isn't just me. It's not something I misconfigured. It is an issue that other people are aware of. And so there's a lot of advantage to what a transparent bug process would bring. And I really hope that gets considered. In the meantime, I don't know, other than like Apple Viz, you know, there's not like a GitHub repository or some such thing that I'm aware of that tracks the accessibility related bugs. And that's unfortunate, because there's also bugs that developers encounter when trying to make stuff accessible. There's things that can't be done, in Xcode. And there's challenges that developers often run into that require Apple to update various frameworks. And that's another sort of part of the puzzle. Not that I would understand that part of the puzzle, but I think for developers, oftentimes they're confronting a challenge that results from a bug in Apple's framework, and they don't know that they're not the only developer encountering that same bug. And it, you know, adds a lot of friction as well. So, I think that's the other, or at least another piece to this.
One thing I like in general too is that, I mean, I've been an ambassador for Apple Accessibility in Australia since 2008. Because I can remember whinging to the lady I'm still working with even now about why can't I play a DVD on my Mac Mini, because as a blind person I don't need to plug in a monitor. And I can remember when I complained back in 2008, it came to her because at that time she was dealing with the deafness community. But the fact that we're in Australia, we've got a group of accessibility ambassadors across the whole realm of disability. So we've got people that are in the autism field, the deafness field, the switch control, low vision, blindness, everything else. And we get together about once a year and have a discussion. The lady I work with in Australia, who's sort of the accessibility type guru for Apple input into Cupertino, I'll often email her about concerns, and then she'll go back to the, or feed it back to the engineers at Cupertino. And it's really nice because even though that Apple knows that I'm a fanboy and I've spoken to people at Cupertino and everything else, they really do let me sometimes go riding off the reservation and, you know, start charging down the street with my sword raised in the air and going, my God, the British are coming, get them out of here. So that actually works really nicely. So, you know, I know Apple gets very touchy in public and marketing and everything else, but I find because I'm in a fairly unique position at working at Vision Australia, but also being an ambassador for Apple. And because I'm not an official Apple employee, I'm allowed that leeway to, you know, quote, bag the crap out of Apple when it needs to be bagged out sometimes.
There's a site, Open Radar, that I know folks in the Apple community have used before to basically duplicate the private feedback that they submit to Apple. And so it goes on to Open Radar so that people can kind of track them. And then it is, of course, the duty of those people to keep them updated and talk about it. Over time, I think that Open Radar may have fallen by the wayside, but that idea certainly exists out there. And I love, as you had suggested, the opportunity to say, hey, here's what has changed. Here's what still needs to be changed. Because, yeah, that you made the very, very, very good point that if there was something that kept the screen from displaying content, that would not, they would wait, they would fix that before it ever went out. And so the idea that any of these bugs that literally make it so that some portion of the population cannot interact with the device in a way that is useful, that shouldn't get to make it out there. And then if it does make it out there, making sure that people know about it as quick as possible would be great. So I hope that comes about.
I'd love to have us talk about the future, and particularly something that people are talking a lot about in the mainstream world as well, and that is AI, whether you define that as AI generally, artificial intelligence or Apple intelligence. Everybody's talking about it in one way or another. In the accessibility community, we've been aware of AI or machine learning based tools for a while because there are several things out there, third-party apps and things that Apple provides within its operating systems that use machine learning to allow people who are blind or low vision to do things they can't otherwise do. There are apps like Be My Eyes and Aira out there that employ artificial intelligence to interpret the contents of photos, which is more than just saying, oh, the dog's on the left and the person on the right. It's about saying, what does this piece of paper actually say? How much is my electric bill? What ingredients do I need to make this thing? What color is this shirt? So there's actually useful, actionable information provided by AI. So I think a lot of people in the disability community, when they hear AI, they think, oh my goodness, it's given me so much that I didn't have before. Whereas people in the wider world sometimes think, oh, AI, oh my God, it's going to, you know, destroy us all or whatever it is. So in other words, AI creates a lot of strong reactions. I know I put a lot in that statement, and there is a question in there somewhere, which basically is how do you think about artificial intelligence, both in terms of the promise it has for giving people with disabilities new capabilities, and also the risks that it poses?
Well, don't forget about how great it's been to be able to create transcripts now for podcasts, for audio and for video. Yep. That to me is one of the biggest things I'm seeing is everybody's doing it. And I think one of the odd benefits, you know, a lot of people, when they see accessibility stuff, they take it back to, well, it's great for me, even though I don't have this disability. But one of the reasons I think it's all the rage now is because videos now have the transcripts over the top of them so that you can watch, you know, TikTok while you're in a meeting. So it's probably gotten more advances because of stuff like that.
I would like to know if this is a concern that is at all legitimate. The concern that I have had about this, and again, I don't know if it's even a reasonable one, and if it's something that you all feel, is that because AI is less expensive than a human being and doesn't have the requirements that a human being has, it's going to result in the work that is done for smaller groups of people, like the work that's done in accessibility, being handed over to artificial intelligence. And if the artificial intelligence isn't up to snuff or doesn't have the understanding that that a human can provide in a context, that, you know, people are just going to do the bare minimum. Like, that's my concern when it comes to image descriptions, when it comes to, you know, what if Apple in Xcode says you can make your app day one accessible, and all you have to do is hit this button, and then it does Apple intelligence stuff. But then it's saying that, you know, an enter button is something other than what it's supposed to be, that's not what the label, just that is a concern that I have. And I was curious if you feel like there is that concern in the community.
Definitely.
As well.
Yeah. So you have precisely identified a hot button
very much
issue
so right
now. And it actually dates back to before this golden age of generative AI. Most of my episodes are 2 hours long, but I did a 3-hour episode in about, I think it was 2020, on this whole question of what has been called accessibility overlays. And there are companies out there that go to businesses who are scared of being sued for lack of ADA compliance, particularly in the United States. And they say, put your bit of code on our website and we will immunize you against all those litigious blind people. And the trouble is that certainly before the generative AI came along, they just didn't work. I have never found a site that uses some of this accessibility overlay technology that is better as a result of its installation. Now, the trouble is that technology's marching on and generative AI is probably changing the game quite a bit on the subject matter. So not only do we have to consider whether we need to rethink the widespread opposition to this sort of technology, but also it could really change the nature of screen reading. I mean, screen reading is still quite a linear thing. A sighted person can just glance at the screen and see something that stands out visually. But a blind person needs to interrogate the screen or explore the screen, and unless they know in advance that something of interest is in a particular place, and then they can set up like a hotspot on the Mac or something else in Jaws for Windows, a script or something like that to get at that information. But something just doesn't stand out to a blind person in that way. You could make a bit of information spoken, but the developer has to make an effort to do that. Now we're getting to the point where these generative AI models are getting really low latency. So I was quite impressed with the GPT-4o demonstrations and just how low the latency was. What happens then is that you can potentially integrate those models into screen reading itself so that I can either type or speak a question about what's on the screen and get information back instantly in a way that doesn't slow me down. That can also make its way to navigation. So at the moment, you can take a picture of something and you wait a few seconds for the AI to process that picture, and then it will give you a description back, you know, which is the shampoo, which is the conditioner, which is the body wash, that kind of stuff. But it takes a few seconds. But with these models now getting better, the latency will be next to negligible. So that could mean that you could be walking down the street with some sort of future wearable with the AI whispering like a kind of an e-Jiminy Cricket in your ear, telling you what's going on. Now, that's exciting, except what happens if it hallucinates, you know?
yes, and
you're traveling along and you're getting what you think is accurate information and it's garbage. So we're at an inflection point here, and there are all sorts of industries from screen reading to navigation that are going to be disrupted, and it's absolutely critical that we are around the table. Again, nothing about us without us. We must be having input into the way this technology is evolving.
I agree. I think, you know, it's also important to have an honest conversation around what AI can do and can't do. And I don't see a lot of that. For example, there's this thought that I run into frequently about, well, we don't need to have alt attributes provided for images anymore. The AI can just go through and describe all the images. We don't need people to do that. And in, you know, in some instances, that might be very true. But just last weekend, I was in the Pizza Hut app, and Pizza Hut has a hot honey pizza, which sounds delicious. However, VoiceOver decided to describe the image of this. There's, I guess the honey sauce is like red. And VoiceOver said a cutting board with a knife on it covered in blood.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh.
And, oh, no.
And I thought, you know, but if no human checked that, right, that's not what Pizza Hut wants for their image description. They didn't have one, though, for this. And so VoiceOver filled it in.
Pizza.
And, you know, going along with Jonathan's comment around about hallucinations, these are real issues. And so, I mean, I'm excited about the possibility of AI. I think it's going to really empower us in ways that I can sort of imagine, and I think in ways that I can't even begin to imagine, you know? And the promise of that is very exciting. But I think that, unfortunately, I hear people saying, well, you know, we don't really need to do accessibility so much anymore because AI is going to do it. And I've heard that, you know, in a recent Gartner report, you know, quantified that 80% or so of accessibility issues can be detected and remediated with AI. I don't think it's true. But, you know, when leaders read that sort of thing and decide, well, gosh, we don't really need an accessibility team. If we're able to catch 80% of the issues with AI, why do we need to employ people with disabilities to tell us stuff? It's way cheaper to just do this AI thing. And that's not a good idea. And so I think the conversation really needs to be had around what the AI can do and what we still do need humans to be able to do, because otherwise there's a lot of marketing hype around, you know, AI solves this issue, and overlays are a prime example of that. There are some QE tools that also boast AI and how amazing the tools are because they have this AI and they can find all these issues and so on and so forth. And in all of that marketing hype is sort of the question of, you know, does it really, you know? So I think we need to approach with caution. I'm very optimistic about the possibilities AI will open up for us. I'm excited because I know there's a lot that I can't even imagine right now that, you know, if we get together around this virtual table in 10 years, we'll look back and say, oh gosh, remember when we thought image description was the big deal? Now look what we can do. You know, I think it's going to be really incredible, but I am very concerned that decisions are going to be made around the importance of the human in all of this accessibility stuff. And that, that could lead to severe consequences, for us.
Yeah, one thing that I keep in mind too is we're all moving into the AR VR world now, and there seems to be not much conversation happening about the implications for accessibility. And the thing that I always get irritated with Apple about is to do with the Vision Pro, because the Vision Pro does accessibility. It interacts with digital objects in that accessibility AR, VR space, but it does not act with the real world. So what I'm really looking forward to is the time that either Vision Pro becomes a set of, quote, smart glasses rather than this AR, VR headset, and then you can then use third-party apps to then interact with the world. So you can do object recognition, you can do object detection, all that sort of cool stuff. And the other thing that I think we're going through at the moment is, because I'm always disappointed by assistive technology products that sort of say, you know, we can do object recognition really, really well. We can do this and that very well. But I have a funny feeling that the mainstream industry, so let's think of things like the Meta Ray-Ban sunglasses, the mainstream industry is catching up to what we finally call assistive technology. And I think what we probably start need to doing now is having more input into those mainstream companies again, because before we could, you know, really rely on third-party assistive technology developers like Envision, like Orcam and so on. But I think now we have got Meta, we've got hopefully Vision Pro growing up a little bit in the next 12 months or so, and other mainstream products coming onto the market. I think that's when we really start need to make sure that, I mean, we've probably missed out the, you know, the ground floor a bit, but I think we need to start having a lot more input and get back to Jonathan's comment about the fact that, you know, it really has to be us involved in the process, because otherwise people just really won't get the implications of eventually the impact upon software and hardware.
I think that's a great way to bring our conversation to a close. Thank you for that, David. And thank you all so much for being here. I want to go around and give everybody an opportunity. We'll have this in the show notes as well, but I want to give everybody an opportunity to tell the folks listening out there where they can find you on the web, or any other social media place, where whatever you're doing that you want people to know about, let the folks know. David Woodbridge, where can people find you on the web?
They can find me on Mastodon and on X, previously called Twitter. I think it's funny people still say that, previously called Twitter. So if you just search for David WoodBR, as in David Woodbridge, you'll find me on those two social media platforms. I do a weekly radio program called Talking Tech for Vision Australia Radio, and that's a bit of a smattering of both mainstream and assistive technology. And then I've also got my original IC podcast, been running from around 2009, and that's on the Podbean, or you can find it on your favourite podcasting application. So that's just called IC, Various Technologies from a Blind Person's Perspective.
Thank you for being here, David, and thank you for being up the earliest of any of us. And I think the second earliest is Jonathan Mosen coming to us from New Zealand. Jonathan, where can people find you?
Probably the easiest way is to just check out the Living Blindfully podcast. You can go to livingblindfully.com for that, and you'll find transcripts and episodes there. It's also available wherever you get your podcast. We publish a 2-hour episode every week full of listener contributions and interaction and interviews with movers and shakers. And if you are interested in this stuff, it isn't just a technology podcast that we do. We look at a lot of social, political issues all through a blindness lens, so it's quite a live podcast.
Thank you for being here. Micah Sargent, thank you so much for your great questions and for joining us. Where can people find you?
If you're looking for me online, I can be found at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee. That's where I've got links to all the places I'm.
I hear you like dogs, Micah.
Yeah, it's very cute.
Maybe.
And Steve Sawson, where can people find you online?
Well, this may change now that I just learned that .coffee is a top-level domain. My name is a little challenging to spell, but I managed to snag steves.life, no .com or anything. So steves.life, sort of a work in progress as I sort of try to figure out WordPress things, but contact info for all the more difficult to spell stuff can be found on steves.life. And I will also have to check out the .coffee and see what I might be able to do there, because I do love coffee.
Ed Allison Sheridan, famously a collector of blind people. And so I guess we're all collected now.
I just updated my list, Shelley, that's for sure. I like to tell people everything good starts with podfeed.com. You can find all of my podcasts and my extensive blog work there. And you can find me anywhere on, I'm pretty much active mostly on Mastodon at Podfeed.
Thank you for being here as well. Thanks, everybody. And thanks, everyone, for listening. This was a really great discussion. Went some places that I didn't expect, which in my opinion is the best kind of podcast. Well, there you have it, the final episode of Parallel, and it was a pretty good one, if I do say so myself, thanks to my wonderful guests. I feel like this is the most guests I've had on any episode of Parallel, if not the most, at least tied for the most, and I think the show turned out really well, so thanks to all of them. Thanks to all of you who listen to this show. I started it in 2015 as an independent podcast, joined Relay a couple of years later, and continued to produce shows. I tried to do it every couple of weeks, but personal and professional obligations got me down in such a way that I wasn't able to keep doing that. And I also, frankly, wasn't getting, as I mentioned last show, the financial opportunities and support that I needed to make the time commitment work out. So I'm just having to step away. And I'm really going to miss it. I miss having a platform and the opportunity to call somebody up and say, hey, would you come on the podcast and talk with me about accessibility for an hour? But podcasts need to be fed. We need to do a show every week, every 2 weeks in a reliable way so that people will know to stay subscribed and know that they can count on episodes being out there. And that's not a promise I could make. And so unfortunately, I have to say goodbye for that reason. I will continue to be on Mastodon. I'll continue to publish my accessibility book for about iOS. I will continue to contribute to Six Colors, including posts on accessibility. I also hope that my friends in the accessibility community will continue to talk to me and have me on their podcasts and consult me when they have questions about what's going on in the accessibility world, because that's a role I've really enjoyed fulfilling for folks. I also hope that you out there who listen to this show will look around at the continually growing landscape of podcasts. You heard from some podcasters on the show today who are making really good content about accessibility. I've also had other podcasters on who are doing really cool stuff. And so I really hope that you'll give their shows a listen too. Last but not least, the Parallel feed is not going away. It will stay on the Relay site. And if you want to support Parallel even in its decline, the best way you can do that is to go out and buy yourself an accessibility sprinkles shirt. Those are still out there and available. So if you want to wear that proudly, I would love it if you do that. It's a shirt that says accessibility sprinkles, and sprinkles is in a very cool set of colors that look like little pieces of candy. I love that shirt, and I'd love to see more of them out there in the wild. Thanks again to everybody who has been a part of Parallel, whether as a guest, as a listener, to Stephen and to Mike, who gave me the opportunity to put the show on the network, to all of the Relay hosts who actually listened when I chewed their ear off about accessibility, and to those of you who have learned about accessibility through this show. I really appreciate your being out there, and I hope we'll be able to talk in the future. We're at relay.fm/parallel, and I am at Shelley@zeppelin.flights on Mastodon if you want to keep in touch. Bye now.